If you have your Bible with you, would you take it out, please, and turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. We'll begin reading in verse 2 here in just a moment of Matthew chapter 5. And that'll serve as a jumping off point for our thoughts this morning. It is so good to see everybody here this morning. We have a number who are visiting with us, and we appreciate so much your presence. Some are pretty regular visitors as you come in and out of town for college or whatever the case might be, but whatever's brought you here this morning, we're glad that you're here, and we hope that you've been encouraged by the things that we've done, and we've been encouraged by your presence as well. Do we have some teachers in the audience? I mean, I asked that question. I put like 90 names on the board just the other day, right? I know we have some teachers out here. Let me ask you this. What's the best way to teach somebody something? And by that I mean, given these two choices, which would you pick? Either tell them all of the ways that something is wrong, or tell them the one way that something is right. Where would you begin on that? For instance, if you were teaching them 2 plus 2, would you say 2 plus 2 is not 1, is not 2, is not 3, is not 5, is not 6, is not 7, is not 8, is not 9, is not 10? Now, certainly, they could extrapolate from the information that you've given that there's a high likelihood that 2 plus 2 is 4, but wouldn't it be simpler? Wouldn't it be easier? Wouldn't it be more effective just to say 2 plus 2 equals 4? Jesus, when he was introducing his kingdom, he does exactly the same thing. In Matthew chapters 5 through 7, there are certainly some prohibitions, some thou shalt nots, don't do this. But when Jesus begins to describe and show what a citizen of his kingdom is, he begins by describing what they are and what they ought to do. And then he gets into some things that they ought not do, but he begins by saying, this is who you are and this is what you do. Will you begin reading those verses with me there in Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 2? He opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, it's interesting. A lot of times we focus in on the qualities, and that's rightfully so. We should focus in on those qualities, saying, if you want to be part of God's kingdom, these are the qualities you have to have. You have to be poor in spirit. You have to mourn. You have to be meek. You have to hunger and thirst for righteousness. But it's interesting, he says these people will be blessed, that they'll be approved by God and they'll receive these blessings. And maybe sometimes we don't spend enough time talking about all of the things that we receive when we have these qualities. Theirs, a person like this, is the kingdom of heaven. This kind of person will be comforted. They shall inherit the earth. They shall be filled. They shall obtain mercy. They shall see God. They shall be called sons of God. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that beautiful that this is what Christ offers? He says, you become like this, and these are the blessings that I will give you. But those blessings are not just to be hoarded for us. Those blessings are intended to be shared with others as well. He says down in verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You know, in your spice cabinet, maybe this is just with us. Maybe it's not with y'all. But if you ever open that up and there's a spice in there you want, and you get it out and you go like this and nothing comes out, and you bang on the side of it, and you go like this, and nothing comes out because it's hard as a rock in there. It's good for nothing. What do? You throw it in the trash, right? It's lost its purpose. It's lost what it's supposed to be doing. And for us as Christians, what we're supposed to be doing is being salt of the earth. We're supposed to be making the world a better place because we're in it. And if we're not making the world a better place, well, then we're not one of these who are blessed. The more familiar example that we know in verse 14. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. I'm reminded of what God told Abram at the time in Genesis chapter 12. He describes all of the blessings that he would receive, right? But he doesn't just say that you are going to be blessed. He says you're going to be blessed and you will be a blessing to others. And that's exactly how Jesus begins as well. God began that first covenant back there with Abraham that would turn into this covenant with Moses. He began it by saying, I'm going to bless you and you're going to be a blessing. And then Jesus begins his covenant by saying, I'm going to bless you and you're going to be a blessing to other people. This, ladies and gentlemen, is who a Christian is. This is who a Christian is supposed to be. That we are blessed by God, and we're a blessing to other people as well. But can I admit something to you? There's an odd phrase in verse 16. Did you catch that? Let your light so shine before men. Let your light shine? You know, because we're in a religious environment, and because we've been singing This Little Light of Mine since we were 6 years old or whatever, that doesn't come across as strange to our ears. But isn't that kind of strange? Let your light shine. I mean, what else does light do, right? What else does light do besides shine? That's kind of like saying, let your water wet. Well, yeah, that's what water is. That's what water does, right? He says, let your light shine. This is what you were created to do. This is who you are. That you were created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that you should walk in them. He said, I redeemed you. I saved you by grace through faith that you might be a blessing to other people. This is who you are, Christian. You are the light of the world. That when people see your light, when they see the way you act, when they see the way you live, they look at you and they see Jesus and they glorify our Father in heaven. That's our purpose. That's why we're here. That's what all this is about. But I'm afraid sometimes we talk about that in such grandiose terms. We look at it on such a macro level, right? That we miss what exactly that looks like on a day-to-day basis. You are the light of the world. But what's included in that? What are we talking about? And so this morning, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take it from that macro level, the light of the world, and I would like to bring it into a micro level. Let's make this personal. Let's make this practical, because that's exactly what the Bible does as well. This whole salt and light thing is played out in a practical way that is much more personal, much more intimate, if I could put it in those terms. It is not really the world that needs us, but individual people in our lives with whom we have the most interaction and influence. You are the light of the world. That reminds me of what is perhaps the most well-known scripture in all the Bible, John 3 and verse 16. For God so loved the world, that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Now that's true, for God so loved the world, all people. But that verse really hits us when we make it personal. I want you to look at these words with me, and what I want you to do is I want you to insert your name. For God so loved Reagan that He gave His only begotten Son, that if Reagan believes in Him, Reagan should not perish, but have everlasting life. God loved me that much. But I didn't just put Reagan in there so that you could put your name in there, for God so loves Andrew. Here's what I really want you to do. I want you to think about the person that you're having the most trouble with in your life right now. The person with whom you have the most conflict, the person with whom perhaps there is an adversarial relationship, the person that tempts you in ways that you don't like to be tempted, and I want you to put their name right there. For God so loved Stephanie. No, just kidding. Just kidding. For God so loved who? That He gave His only begotten Son. That if that person believes in Him, that person should not perish, but have everlasting life. And what has God called us to do with that person? Not with the world, but with that person. Be salt and light. So too that concept that's found in Mark chapter 16 and verse 15, where Jesus says to His apostles, and I understand this is to the apostles, but certainly it has application to us. Go therefore into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. You know what is included in all the world? All those foreign fields where they speak different languages, where they've never heard about Jesus, certainly. But it also includes my next door neighbor. This verse means go across the street and preach the gospel to every creature. Go into the office and preach the gospel to every coworker. Go into all your family and preach the gospel to every cousin. Go into the store and preach the gospel to every employee. At the very least, we should be proclaiming Jesus by our actions on a daily, personal, intimate basis with the people we come in contact with. You're going to go anyway, right? You're going to go to work. You're going to go be with your family. You're going to go have fun. You're going to go to those places. What is your purpose in being there, if not to share the gospel with those folks? You are the light of the world. Well, that means you are the light of your family. You are the light of your workplace. You are the light of your classroom. You are the light of your school. You are the light of your team. You are the light of your marriage. You are the light of your friends. You are the light of Facebook. You are the light of Instagram. You are the light of Snapchat. And let me tell you, if there's any place that needed light, it's Snapchat. You are the light of the world in all of these areas. Is the world seeing light? So let your light shine. How dumb is it to take that light? Yes, it's dumb. It doesn't make any sense. How dumb is it to take that light, to put it on this table and say, I'm going to give light to the house? Nope. And that's all they had. I mean, they're not flipping the fluorescence on, right? What sense does it make to hide it under a basket? It makes no sense. This is who we are, so this is what we do. We let our light shine. You are the light to all of these people in your life. And may I suggest that as you are salt and light, you either win them or you can lose them without a word. Our actions, our example, our lives have that kind of power to win and lose souls. Turn, if you would, to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. So, we've looked at the macro. We've looked at this from a very general sense of the world. Let's get personal. 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. Wives. Likewise. Okay, so not just wives. We're talking about all those relationships that we have with one another. And I think what he applies here would apply to those relationships. Servants and masters, husbands and wives, children and parents. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands. That even if some do not obey the word, they're not Christians. They're not obeying what God would have them to do. They, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. People are won and people are lost by the way that we live too. Every single one of us in all of our relationships, are we winning them to Christ or losing them from Christ? Because of our conduct, because of our influence. Well, there's two choices, right? Let's look at the negative first. Let's get this out of the way so we can get back to the positive in this. Lost? Well, if they're going to be lost, let me tell you this. It's not going to be because of me. It's not because I am their excuse in these things. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4 says that God desires all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. Why? Because God created them in His image, and His whole goal was to get that person back into a right relationship with Him. That's what God desires from every single person. That name that you put up there, He sent His Son to make that happen because He desires for them to be saved. God desires it, and so should we. I don't even like to think about that, that people are going to be lost, that people are going to spend an eternity in hell. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy because I wouldn't want it myself. And how much worse if I am a contributing factor to that being the case, that I am their excuse for not doing what's right? How dare I thwart the plans and purposes of God by doing something that gets in the way? Here's God, here's them, and there I am in the way. Instead of pulling them toward God, I'm a barrier between them and reconciliation with God. What an awful, terrible thought that I should be in that position. Can I go Mike Penn on you for just a second? God took that spirit and He put it in that body. You heard this talk? Probably so, right? And He put that spirit in that body. And He wants that spirit to come back and be with Him. And if I am a detriment, a deterrent, if I am a stumbling block to keep that spirit from getting back to God who created it, then I will have to give an account for that. Well, isn't that exactly what we find in Matthew chapter 18? This is reconciliation between God and those that He loves. Those that He loves so much that He gave His only begotten Son. And what am I doing to either facilitate that reconciliation or to be a barrier, a stumbling block to it? Notice what He says. Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 6. Here are the stakes. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in Me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. So He says, people are going to sin. Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, but I'm not going to be the reason why they sin. Offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offenses come. And how big are the stakes for this? Well, He says it would be better if a millstone were hung about his neck and he were drowned in the sea. Now, this is the only millstone that I can think of that I've seen in person. This is at the Gunther House in San Antonio, best breakfast in San Antonio. And just outside, because it's at this big mill, right? There's this original millstone that came over from France in the 1800s at some point. And it's about yay high and about yay thick. And it's probably approximately a billion pounds, right? You know what I think of when I saw that millstone for the first time? My dad and I, we used to stay up late on Friday nights and watch the World's Strongest Man competitions. You know, these meatheads like this, and they would get these big rocks and they'd have to put them on columns and stuff like that. That's what it reminded me of, this millstone. But you know what would happen if you took some rope and you put it right through that hole right there, and then you tied it around this dude's neck, World's Strongest Man at some point, I don't know what year, and you threw him into the sea. What's going to happen? That dude's going to drown. I don't care if it's Michael Phelps, he's going to drown, right? And He said, it would be better that you are drowned in the sea with this millstone. You're not coming up for air, that's where you're going. Than to cause someone else to sin in such a way that they be lost. and separated from their God. That's how serious this is. And how far should we be willing to go to keep this from happening? Well, notice what he says in verses 8 and 9. This is a repeat of something he said back there in Matthew chapter 5. And in Matthew chapter 5, it was about my sin, about my lust, about my issues. And he says, hey, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Now it's talking about me causing someone else to sin. How far should I go to keep that from happening? If your hand or foot causes you to sin in this way, by causing others to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. I mean, think about that. It's not just that you cut it off. I mean, if I'm cutting it off, I'm holding it to me. No, cut it off. You take your left hand. I know this isn't very athletic, throwing with your left hand, right? And you cast it from you. I don't even want to sew it back on. If it's causing me to sin in this way, get it away from me. Cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet and to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes be cast into hellfire. And so, in verses 10 and 11, what does he say? Well, here is the reality from God's perspective. Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. Now, I don't know exactly what that means, but it means they've got friends in high places. That God is seeing these people. And He's seeing the way I'm interacting with them. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. My purpose is to be salt and light. Jesus' purpose was to save that which was lost. And that continues to be His purpose even today. This is what we ought to be doing. We ought to have this perspective. And so what does that mean in a practical sense? I hope I'm not going to have to cut off my hand to keep others from sinning, right? But if we turn to Romans chapter 14, there's a real life New Testament example. The example is there were some folks who were eating some food that was resold in the marketplace that at one time had been sacrificed to an idol, but now it's just meat. It's just meat that's cheap. You know, you went to the clearance section of HEB and this is the meat. It expires tomorrow, but you can still eat it today. And so it's easier. It's cheaper. And he says this is what they were eating. But there were some Christians there that had a background in paganism. And so they see their brother or sister eating this meat and they say, well, they're worshiping an idol. They weren't really. But in their eyes, that's what it looked like. That's what it appeared like. And so it was causing them to sin. Notice what he says in verse 13. Let us resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. Verse 15. Yet if your brother is grieved because of your food, you are no longer walking in love. Do not destroy with your food the one for whom Christ died. Christ says, why did you do this? You destroyed the one that I love. I wanted to eat this meat. Let the mountains fall on us to hide us in shame. If our trivial rites are keeping others from their God. Did they have a right to eat this meat? Sure, they could. But they should be willing to give it up for the good of their brother. We are destroying with our food. And when you see food, just replace it with my right to do what I want. This is what I want. I am destroying the one for whom Christ died. What should our attitude be? Well, notice what Paul says about the same issue in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 11, again, the same issue of eating these meats sacrificed to idols. He says in verse 11, and because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. Okay, you know more than they do. Good job. Are you really going to make them perish because they don't know everything yet because they're still weak in the faith?
But when you thus sin against the brethren, now eating that meat in and of itself, that wasn't wrong. But you do it in such a way to offend another, now you're sinning. When you sin thus against a brother and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, Paul says, lest I make my brother stumble. My rights? Give them up. Justice has to be served. Well, he says in chapter 6, be cheated. They haven't suffered enough for the things that they have done. Well, neither have I. I have a greater knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. Well, then I need to show love and patience and long-suffering. Forgive the one who has wronged me and move on. Because I'm not going to be the barrier that keeps them from getting to heaven. What trips them up? They may be lost, yes. But let me guarantee you, it's not going to be because of me. Not because of the things I have done. And I'm not saying ignore sin. I'm saying just the opposite. Do everything in your power to keep sin from happening. And if that requires some sort of sacrifice or service on my part, so be it. The other day, I was driving back to the office back there from the hospital. And I cut through on a road that I don't normally drive on. And I was looking over, there was this empty lot. And my eye is always drawn toward basketball goals. I mean, it's just an old habit, right? But I see this basketball goal and I whip into another driveway and turn around so that I can take a picture. This is what I saw. Here's the basketball goal on this great piece of driveway right here. There's no house here. The house has been torn down. And then there's one tree between you and the basketball goal there at the street, and it says, private property, no trespassing. Come on, man. You put the basketball goal up. I imagine myself as a 16-year-old who loved basketball. This would have been a great temptation for me. Let me just be honest. But I want you to imagine, I don't know why that no trespassing sign is up there. There might be a really good reason for it. But I want you to imagine for just a moment that the neighbor had a 16-year-old who loved basketball. And they see this basketball put up. And so the father of the 16-year-old or the 16-year-old himself comes and says, hey, I saw the basketball goal. Can I play on that? And they say, nope, you sure can't. Well, that's their right, isn't it? It's their basketball goal. They put it up. It's their property and they have the right to say no. And you know what else they have the right to do? They have the right to put up the no trespassing sign as well. But to the 16-year-old basketball player, this is entrapment. And how does it look if they're there at the blinds and they've got their binoculars looking out at the basketball goal and there he comes and he's playing basketball and we call the cops and say, sir, we've got a trespasser. Yeah, he shouldn't have done it. Yeah, he's going to bear some consequences because he did. But isn't that just the worst? Here's an idea. Let's not be the worst. If we know something is a temptation to our brother or sister in Christ, I can give it up. I can give it up if it's going to help them get to heaven. You know, I don't know what judgment is going to be like. Yes, they may be judged for that, but so will we, right? I have a lot of questions about judgment, don't you? Like when do we figure out which side we're on? Especially if the Lord comes again and we're taken up in the clouds. Are we standing there on one side or the other and we kind of look around and we say, you know what, there sure are a lot of people over on this side. And there's some pretty terrible people that are going to be going to heaven. You know, I don't know how it works exactly. I know that there's going to be sentencing involved. And it appears from Matthew chapter 25 when the sheep and goats are divided. Apparently Christ talks to them and they have the ability to talk back. Maybe that's all metaphorical or symbolic. I understand that. But I can almost imagine it, can't you? That somebody goes up there and we know that guy's a terrible person. And he comes before God and God says, hey, did you do this? Did you sin against me in that way? And we speak up from the back row. Yeah, he did. I saw it. I saw him do it. And God says, okay, Reagan, come here, right here.
What'd you do about it? He told me just a second ago that you said such and such, such and such, such and such to him. Did you really say that? Yes, sir. When I stand before God, I don't want to be called up because there's somebody else that's there who's going to go to hell in large part because of what I did. Let us resolve this. Not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. Now, that's all very negative. But it doesn't have to be that way. Are they going to be saved? Well, may Christ use me to save them. May Christ use me to make it happen. I love this verse in the book of Esther. It's the most famous book in the book of Esther. Remember, she's going to have to go before the king to ask for the Jews to be saved. And her cousin Mordecai, who raised her, he's telling her, you've got to do this. And she says, if I do this, I might die. That's the reality. And so he says to her, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. Because God has all these promises that he's going to fulfill. God's going to take care of his people. But you and your father's house will perish. You're going to be held accountable for what you didn't do. Yeah, God can take care of it, but you're going to be held accountable. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Maybe, just maybe, God has put you into their life. This person that is so hard to get along with, this person who is so steeped in sin, maybe God has put you in their life because you are the hope they have to get to heaven. And he has worked providentially behind the scenes to make all of this take place. A few days ago, I was on Facebook, trying to be a light on Facebook. And I saw this video of these border collies, three border collies with a herd of, wait for it, a herd of ducks. There were like six or seven ducks. And these border collies, they were working these ducks. And it's amazing, what comes into the screen on this far side is a hula hoop placed on the ground. And they get these six or seven ducks, and they work them and they work them until those ducks are all standing in the hula hoop. It was incredible to watch. And if God revealed to us all of the ways that he was working, those ducks didn't know what was going on. It was just bumper cars. Oh, there's a dog, there's a dog, there's a dog. Here I am in this hoop. And if we could see all of the ways that God was working providentially behind the scenes, here and there and here and there to bring me to this place so that I can interact with this person, we wouldn't want to waste that kind of opportunity. Who knows whether you have come to the office for such a time as this? Who knows whether you have come to the family for such a time as this? Who knows whether you have come to the classroom for such a time as this? God knows. And God has put you in this place for that purpose. In 1 Peter chapter 3, let's turn back to our main text. And we're just going to stay there in that text as we bring our lesson to a close. 1 Peter chapter 3. Let's read again verses 1 and 2. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Now, this isn't just for wives, it's for husbands too. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 16, for how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? By your actions, by the way that you live, by your influence. How does this happen? Well, there are three things that we find there in 1 Peter chapter 3. How are they won without a word? Well, they are won when they see, when they observe your conduct. They observe the consistency of our lives. And this person, maybe begrudgingly, Ultimately, they glorify God because they see our good works. They say, I might not like it, but that person's really living it. They're not a hypocrite. They're really living the Christian life. And in all honesty, these kinds of intimate, close relationships, like a husband and wife, there is no hiding who we really are from that person. And too many Christians are caught in this trap of multiple personas. I'm one person here, I'm another person there. All that is, there's one word for it in the Bible, hypocrisy. It's hypocrisy. Literally, that word hypocrite means a play actor, somebody who wears a mask. Here's who I really am, but around you, I'm this person. There's no mask for someone who's truly living the Christian life. I am who I am, wherever I am, and whatever I'm doing, because I am salt and light in all the world. And is that really any way to live life, this life of hypocrisy? It isn't a fulfilling life of consequence-free fun. Instead, it just complicates everything. It is a life full of drama and lies and deception. And in the end, when we try and please everyone, we will please no one, certainly not ourselves and certainly not God. We're not helping anyone by pretending to be two different things. And it's hiding our light. It's putting it under a basket. It's darkness. You know, I like to think about things like this. You know, putting biblical characters, we know the way they've acted, the way that they did act. But if you put them in a different scenario and try and imagine them acting in a different way, sometimes it's kind of funny, right? Like people who are devoted to God trying to be hypocrites and try and hide who they are, trying to hide what they were doing. My favorite example is Noah. You think about Noah in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7. He obeyed God. He built the ark. And by this, the world was condemned because of his actions, because he obeyed God and they weren't obeying God. But can you imagine Noah trying to hide who he was as a servant of God, obedient to God? You know, his neighbor comes up to him and says, "Hey, Noah, what you building?" Just a barn, you know, going to put some animals in it at some point, you know, just something like that. Awfully big. Yeah, you know, I might want lots of animals at some point. How silly is that? How silly is it to imagine them hiding who they are? "Hey, Paul, hey, what do you do?" "Oh, I'm a tent maker." "Anything else?" "No, just tents, mostly." Their life was defined by their faith. Their life was defined by who they are in their relationship with God. And so too for us. If we're able to hide who we are, maybe we're not the Christians we think we are. Maybe we're not right with God like we think we are. Because after Jesus saying, "I'm going to bless you in all these ways," he says, "Be salt and be light, that they might see, observe your conduct, and glorify your Father in heaven." What do they observe? Well, they observe your chaste conduct. Chaste is defined as free from all taint or impurity. It primarily implies a refraining from acts or even thoughts or desires that are not pure or not sanctioned by marriage vows. It is pure in thought, pure in act. In a word, this wife is holy. And not just sexually so either, though certainly that's included in chaste. It is a life free from the misbehavior of the world. It is pure conduct in thought, in desire, in action, in reputation, in appearance. There is no cause given to anything impure when someone has chaste conduct. She is the model of proper behavior. The husband doesn't have to have the word. Well, eventually he does. We understand that. But they have that word through them, through the things that they observe. Here is what living the Christian life is all about. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, that fear of God. What is my motivation in doing all of this? Well, I love this person, sure. I want them to get to heaven, sure. But even more because I fear God and I love God. I'm a Christian. That's who I am. That's what I do. I'm salt. I'm light. And I have a relationship with God.
And when they observe me, they observe not just the things that I do, but they know why I do them. Because I put God first in my life. You know the awesome thing about this formula? It works. There's a man I know named Joe. And Joe's wife is named Kathy. These are some Christians that I know in another place. And Kathy is perhaps the sweetest person I've ever known. She's tied maybe with, you know, my mom and Steph. But seriously, she is just one of these awesome, godly Christian women. She consistently lives the Christian life in a quiet and genuine way. And Joe was not a Christian when they married. Kathy was out of duty. She was not faithful when they married, if I understand correctly. But she came back to the Lord, and now she's in this married relationship with this man who is not a Christian. In fact, a hard-living man in many ways. He drank and he worked too much. In many ways, he was what we would just call, he's a good old boy, you know? And he didn't buy into that whole religion thing. He loved his wife. He appreciated her and what she did. And so he put up with her devotion. He put up with her being gone on Sundays. He put up with all those things. But he didn't really like it. He didn't really appreciate it. And finally, at her repeated invitation, he said, I'm not going to go to church with you. But she invited him to come to a fish fry that some of the members of the congregation were putting on at somebody's house. And so Joe said, all right, I'll come to the fish fry. That's fine. And so he goes, and they spent several hours there. Joe told me this story himself. He walked away from that gathering and he said, I wasn't ready to be a Christian yet, but I knew two things that I didn't know before. Number one, the people who attended that church were some of the nicest, most genuine people I had ever been around. And number two, I saw for the first time in my entire life since I was a kid that you can go and have a good time with people without drinking. No word was preached to Joe that evening. No one said, do you know Jesus Christ? But by their conduct, he said, you know what? I think I will visit with you. And over the course of time, he did visit. And discussions about the Bible ensued. And finally, submission to Christ and being born again of water and the Spirit in baptism. Joe was saved by the conduct of Kathy. And Joe is the man he is today because she was salt and light. To the world? Sure. But most especially to Joe. This works, folks. The one consistent in that whole process was Kathy. She was a rock of faithfulness, not just to him, but to the Lord. And I have no issue saying that Joe was saved by the conduct of his wife. The blood of Jesus does the saving, but she was the instrument God used to bring Joe to Christ. And the thing about a spouse is that we can work on them even more because we have vows that keep us together. They're stuck with us, if you want to put it in those terms. But isn't the co-worker stuck with us too? For 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, or even more? Isn't the classmate or the teammate or the teacher stuck with us too? Isn't the in-law stuck with us also? They're forced by the nature of that relationship to observe our chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Thank God. Thank God for such a time as this that they can see what being a Christian is all about because of me. May I be the instrument of God today and tomorrow and every day of our lives that others may be won without a word. We sang a hymn just a moment ago.
We are the only Bible this old world will read. Christ has no hands but our hands. You know, that's hyperbolic. That's hyperbole. God has lots of other ways to accomplish the things that He needs to accomplish in life. But for us, shouldn't we be working with that attitude that Christ has sent me, and I'm going to do what I can to be the kind of person who draws others closer to Him? If we can help you to come closer to Christ even this morning, won't you come now while together we stand and while we sing.